And therefore Buddha himself has said that that there is this risk of perceiving emptiness itself as having true existence. And if you perceive emptiness itself as having true existence, then the Buddha says this is a very grave, serious wrong view which cannot be rectified. Because for removing true existence, you develop the view of emptiness, and then if you perceive that emptiness itself as having true existence, then it's like taking the medicine and then medicine itself becoming a poison. If that which is called emptiness did have some essential existence, then things would have intrinsic nature. However, it does not. In order to indicate this, Aryadeva's 400 stanzas says, as there is nothing that is not empty, from what can emptiness arise? As there is nothing to oppose, how can there be a remedy? If you disagree and you refute the existence of emptiness, which is the absence of intrinsic nature, then the absence of intrinsic nature would not exist. In that case, since essential or intrinsic nature would exist, it would be totally inappropriate to refute intrinsic nature. For in this vein, Nagarjuna's refutation of objection says, how could the absence of intrinsic nature, in my words, refute my claim that things lack intrinsic nature? If the absence of intrinsic nature were refuted, then the presence of intrinsic nature would be proven. And Nagarjuna's commentary on the refutation of objects, commenting on that, says very clearly, objection, just as someone might stop sound with the sound, just as someone might stop sound with the sound, don't make a sound. So the essence of intrinsic existence, in your words, refutes your claim that there is no intrinsic nature in things. So reply, the example is correct, but your point is not. Here words that have no intrinsic nature do refute the intrinsic existence of things. If the essence of intrinsic nature in words could refute the absence of intrinsic nature in things, then this would refute the absence of intrinsic nature itself. Therefore, things would have intrinsic nature, and because of having intrinsic nature, they would not be empty. Therefore, just after the passage in the fundamental truth I cited above, how could there be a trace of emptiness, as Nagarjuna says? The conqueror said that emptiness eradicates all dogmatic views. As for those who take a dogmatic view of emptiness, he said that they are incurable. Again, having a dogmatic view of emptiness does not mean taking the view that things are empty of intrinsic nature. It means thinking of emptiness of intrinsic nature, as still existent, or viewing it as a real thing. As the Buddha Pali's commentary on the fundamental Tretta says this very clearly, giving an example. It's possible to overcome the misconception of those who think that things exist essentially. You can explain emptiness and show them that things are empty of essence, saying, as these are dependent arisings, they are designated as these or that thing through the force of causes and conditions, things do not exist essentially. However, there is no way to overcome the misconception of those who think that emptiness is a real thing. For example, if you tell someone, I have nothing, and then that person says, give me that nothing, how could you make that person understand that you have nothing? If it is not taken in this way, the example would also be inappropriate. Suppose you say to me, give me some money, and I reply, I have no money. And if you conclude this person has no money, then there is no problem. However, if you think of no money as a kind of money, then there is no way that I can assure you that I have no money. In just the same way, suppose you ask, do things have intrinsic nature or not? And I say, they do not have intrinsic nature. If you then think, things do not have intrinsic nature, how could that be a problem? I wanted you to get this idea. However, if you think that things love of intrinsic nature is itself intrinsically existent, then this is a problem. According to your interpretation, when you hear me say that I have no money, and then develop the idea, this person has no money, then even that idea must be refuted. So it would be wonderful for you to rely on what I've said. Also in the clear words, Chandrakirti speaks of clinging to emptiness as a real thing. Hence he is not refuting emptiness itself, and there is no fault in implying having the view of emptiness. The wild summary of the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines says, a bodhisattva who thinks the aggregates are empty is meditating on science and lacks faith in the realm of non-production. Only these and other scriptures and treatises say that it is wrong to have a view of emptiness or selflessness. You should understand them as I have explained above. Otherwise, they would contradict a great many statements in other texts. In the Heart Sutra, Sariputra asks our Lokiteshvara how one who wishes to practice the profound perfection of wisdom should train. In the play, our Lokiteshvara says a Bodhisattva should correctly view these five aggregates as empty of intrinsic existence. Therefore, the root of problem is the ignorance that superimposes intrinsic existence. There is only one consciousness that can uproot it by apprehending things in a way that explicitly contradicts it. That consciousness is the wisdom that knows selflessness, the absence of intrinsic existence. As this is so, if you refute this way of apprehending things, then you will have to admit, albeit unwillingly, that you are refuting the view of reality. At the point where Aryadeva's full understanding says, there is no second door to peace. Although there are the three doors of liberation called emptiness, signlessness and wishlessness, still only the view of selflessness takes priority. If you know phenomena without exception as selfless and thereby extinguish every attachment to all things, then how could you ever long for anything or apprehend signs in anything? Because of this, selflessness alone is the one and only door to peace. Therefore, the equipment of enlightenment explains, because phenomena do not intrinsically exist, they are empty. Further, because phenomena are empty, what use are signs? Inasmuch as they have overcome all signs, why root the learned wish for such a phenomena? Thus, Chandrakirti clears up the apparent contradiction between scriptural explanations that there are three doors to liberation. Now, with regard to the meaning of three doors to liberation, again there are various interpretations. So here we are talking primarily about level of inherent existence in terms of cause, in terms of its entity, in terms of the fruit. So thus Chandrakirti clears up the apparent contradiction between scriptural explanations that there are three doors to liberation and other texts which explain that the view of emptiness of intrinsic existence is the only door to liberation. He uses scripture and reason to prove that just this view is the door to liberation. So why should the mere negation of intrinsic nature imply the refutation of the object of wisdom? It should not, for such knowledge, remedies the conceptions of the two selves as signs, and it lacks even a trace of such a misconception. And if you regard as defective even such a conception and refute all conceptuality of any sort, good or bad, then it's evident that you want to set up the system of the Chinese about Hashang. Next is not negating enough. Refuting an overly restricted identification of the object to be negated. Opponent, the object to be negated is an intrinsic nature that has three attributes. 1. Causes and conditions do not bring it into being. 2. Its condition is immutable. And 3. It is posited without depending on some other phenomenon. As Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, it is not reasonable that a nature should arise from causes and conditions. If it did arise from causes and conditions, then a nature would be something that is made. How could it be unsuitable for a nature to be something that is made? Nature is not fabricated and does not depend on another. I reply, in general, if someone claims that internal and external things, example seedlings, have intrinsic nature in this sense, then Madhyamikas indeed must refute such. However, here identifying the object of the negated means identifying the fundamental object of negation. When you refute the fundamental object of negation, then the Madhyamika view, knowledge that phenomena lack intrinsic nature, develops in your mind stream. Fallacies arise if we follow this opponent's interpretation, See, the partisans of non-Madhyamaka Vidya schools have already established that compounded phenomena are produced by causes and conditions and are mutable. We should not have to demonstrate to them the absence of intrinsic nature. They also should have recognized the things like intrinsic nature. So how can this be the unique Madhyamaka object of negation? And many Madhyamaka texts adduce arguments such as, if things exist essentially, and so in the earlier section, the earlier topic, what we have studied is what is known as over-application. So over-application means that you negate the object of negation so much that you even refute the conventional existence, so that you are unable to come up with any presentation. You are unable to talk about even the mere existence. So on this second topic we are reading, not negating enough. Now many Madhyamika texts adduce arguments such as, if things exist essentially, then they could not depend on causes and conditions. They would have to be immutable and so forth. However, these statements indicate fallacies that would be entailed if things exist essentially. They do not identify the object of negation on its own terms. It is the case that if something existed ultimately, existed in duality or truly existed, then it could not depend on causes and conditions and so forth. However, that is not what ultimate existence means. For example, even though being a pot entails being impermanent, impermanent is not the proper meaning of pot. Rather, you have to say that it means a bulbous, splay-based thing, able to perform the function of holding water. So here what we are talking about is the ultimate reality, and when we talk about object of negation, we are talking about the recognition of that object of negation which must be negated for understanding the ultimate reality. Now likewise, if something existed ultimately, etc., it would have to be a partless thing. Still here in Madhyamika, we do not suggest that partless thing is the fundamental object of negation. Since partless things are merely imputed from the unique perspective of advocates of philosophical tenets, such notions are not the fundamental cause that binds embodied beings in circle existence. Further, even if you determined that those partless things lack intrinsic nature and then meditate on that, this would not at all counter the ignorant conception which has operated from beginningless time. Therefore, even optimal and direct knowledge of that would not overcome the innate afflictions. Thus, when making philosophical determinations, make your principal task to determine that an object as conceived by innate ignorance does not exist. Ancillary to that, refute objects of acquired misconceptions. If you do not understand this and fail to eradicate the perspective of innate ignorance, then when you refute a personal self, you will only refute a self that is permanent, unitary and independent. When you refute an objective self, you will only refute things that are imputed by the advocates of philosophical tenets, such as objects that are partless particles, partless moments of experience, or natural substrate with three strands asserted by the Samkhyas. This is completely inappropriate. If you think otherwise, then when you make philosophical determinations, you will establish nothing more than this shallow selflessness. As philosophical determinations are made for the purposes of meditation, when you meditate, you will have to meditate only on this. Therefore, even if you actualize such a selfless in meditation and consummated your cultivation of it, nothing would come of it. It would be extremely absurd to claim that you can overcome innate afflictions by seeing as non-existent the true selves imputed by acquired misconceptions. As Chandrakirti's commentary on the Middle Way says, when knowing selflessness, some eliminate a permanent self. But we do not consider this the basis of the conception of the inborn I. It is therefore astonishing to claim that knowing this selflessness expunges and uproots the view of self. So meaning that by understanding the grosser form of selflessness, you will not be able to understand the subtle selflessness. And also Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, to illustrate this very point, the irrelevance of such two inept afflictions by way of an example. Someone sees a snake living in the wall of his house. To ease this concern, someone else says, don't worry, there is no elephant here. So this will not remove the fear of the presence of the snake. So alas, to others it is ridiculous to suppose that this would dispel the fear of the snake. Chandrakirti refers to the selflessness of the person, but it's the same for the selflessness of objects. You could have added, when knowing selflessness, some eliminate an acquired conception of self, but we do not consider this the basis of ignorance. It's therefore astonishing to claim that knowing the selflessness expunges and uproots ignorance. Question. In the statement by Nagarjuna set forth above, he says that the defining characteristics of a nature are not being fabricated, not depending upon something else. Was he speaking hypothetically, or does such a nature exist? Reply. The Buddha posits a nature, saying this is the reality of phenomena. It's not fabricated and does not depend on something else. Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary establishes that it exists, citing a sutra source. Is there a nature that has such qualifications as the Master Nagarjuna claims? Yes, it is the reality of which the Bhagavan spoke extensively, saying, whether Tathagatas appear or not, the reality of phenomena remains. What is this reality? It is the nature of things such as these eyes. And what is their nature? It is that in them which is neither fabricated nor dependent upon something else. It is their identity as known by knowledge free from the impairment of ignorance. Does it exist or not? If it did not exist, for what purpose would Bodhisattvas cultivate the path of the perfections? Why would Bodhisattvas undergo hundreds of hardships in order to know reality? Question. Did you not previously argue that all phenomena live intrinsic nature? Reply. Even phenomena that are not internal mental constructs, like even a particle of essential or intrinsic nature. Have you not given this answer several times? Therefore, what need is there to speak of other phenomena in terms of such a nature? Even reality, the ultimate truth, has no intrinsic nature at all, as Chandrakirti's clear word says. Thus Chandrakirti refutes the view that this nature exists essentially. He says that it exists conventionally. Objection. He does not assert that it exists, for he says that he reifies it in order to avoid frightening listeners. Reply. That is not reasonable. He also spoke of other phenomena, having imputed them for that same reason. So if the final nature did not exist, those other phenomena also would not exist. As cited earlier, Chandrakirti proves that the final nature exists, making the argument that if it did not exist, then it would absolutely follow that pure conduct is senseless. Also, Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, if it were otherwise, then you would have to hold that in Madhyamika it is impossible to attain freedom. This is because, one, Chandrakirti says that to attain Nirvana means to perceive Nirvana, and he says that Nirvana is considered a true cessation, and the true cessation are ultimate truths. And true ultimate truths would not exist. In his commentary on the 60 stanzas of reasoning, Chandrakirti takes pains to prove that when you attain Nirvana, you must perceive the ultimate truth of cessation. Accordingly, compounded phenomena such as eyes are not natures in the sense of being essentially existent, nor are they natures when reality is posited as the final nature. So they are neither sort of nature. Ultimate truths are natures when reality is posited as the final nature. But what establishes them as such natures is that they are non-fabricated and do not depend upon something else. They do not at all exist as natures in the sense of being essentially existent, thus they exist merely conventionally. Fabricated means produced in the sense of a new occurrence of something that did not exist before. To depend upon something else means to depend on causes and conditions. since forms and so forth are neither type of nature, when you speak of cultivating the path in order to view the final nature, nature has the sense of reality. Therefore, Chandrakirti says that pure conduct is no senseless. Moreover, he explains that his utter lack of an assertion that phenomena have a nature in the sense of essential existence does not contradict his incidental assertion of final nature, as Chandrakirti says. Now, since all the Buddhist philosophical schools do talk about Nirvana, but in the ultimate sense, unless you have a proper understanding of the actual ultimate nature of the mind, it is not possible to understand the actual meaning of Nirvana. Here, thing and non-thing refers to essential existence and utter non-existence, as explained above in the section on dualism. Now, when you as an ordinary being determine that phenomena like even a particle of essential intrinsic nature, you find that emptiness of intrinsic nature is an attribute of the phenomena, such as form, that serve as its substrata. Thus, it is not contradictory for both substrata and attribute to be objects of a single mind, since you have not stopped dualistic appearance, that emptiness is a nominal rather than actual ultimate truth. So with regard to this explanation of true cessation or nirvana, in the small stages of meditation there is a quotation where it says that emptiness means the ultimate reality. So whether you use the term emptiness or suchness, it refers to ultimate reality. And this emptiness, which lacks inherent existence, is suchness. And when you meditate on it, you will realize it. And having realized it, when you meditate on it, then finally, when you remove the seed of affluent emotions and achieve a state of fabrication, achieve a state where there is no fabrication, then that emptiness itself is called transcendence of suffering. That itself is the nirvana or liberation. And in Nagarjuna's fundamental, in Tsongkhapa's commentary of Nagarjuna's fundamental wisdom, he again clearly says that Nirvana refers to that ultimate nature of the mind. And among Tsongkhapa's followers, there are two viewpoints. One who says that true cessation is emptiness, and others say it is not emptiness. But here there is a clear citation which says that true cessation is emptiness. Accustoming yourself to the view which knows the absence of intrinsic nature, you will know it by perceiving it. For such a consciousness, all mistaken appearances stop. Mistaken appearance here means the appearance of intrinsic existence where there is no intrinsic existence. Therefore, since the consciousness directly perceiving that reality does not perceive substrata such as forms, neither the reality nor its substrate exist from the perspective of that mind. So emptiness and forms, etc., must be posited as reality and substrate from the perspective of some other mind, a conventional mind. As this is so, an ultimate truth is posited where, in addition to the stilling of all elaborations of essential existence, there is also a sheer stoppage of all elaborations of mistaken appearances, appearances of intrinsic existence where there is none. Thus, while we assert a final nature, how could we be forced to accept an essentially existent nature, as Chandrakirti's clear word says? Driven by the impairment of ignorance, ordinary beings perceive a certain aspect in things. As noble beings who are free from the impairment of ignorance do not see that mistaken aspect, there is something else that serves as their object. That very entity is posited as the final nature of those things. Also, things live of intrinsical existence production is not anything. Thus, since it is just a non-thing, it is no essence. Therefore, it is not the intrinsic nature of things. So, one thing that we again need to understand is now when we talk about emptiness, for example, as we read earlier, thus it is not contradictory for both substrata and attributes to be objects of a single mind, meaning that since you have not stopped dualistic appearances, the emptiness is nominal rather than actual ultimate truth. So what we should understand here is that when we talk about emptiness, it has to be explained in relation to a particular object. It is the very nature of that object. And in the absence of any basis in the form of an object, we cannot talk about an emptiness. So it is by analyzing the nature of an object like a form that you are able to see emptiness. So in the beginning we see the object, and then we analyze the nature of that object, and then gradually we are able to see the nature of that ultimate nature of that object. So that's the meaning of the statement saying that the emptiness is an attribute of the phenomena, such as form that serves as it is substrata. So that form is the base of the substrata. And once you realize this and meditate more on emptiness, and then the appearance of that substrata will gradually disappear, and gradually your mind will merge into that nature of emptiness. But when the appearance of the conventional truth becomes less and less, through the four stages of the path of application and so forth, then the appearances and perception of conventional truth becomes less and less, and then finally when you reach a path of seeing, all dualistic appearances cease and you will know it directly. So when that mind is totally absorbed and lost in that emptiness, then there is no dualistic appearance. Dualism in the sense of subject-object distance, or in terms of appearance of generic image. So therefore, the emptiness or ultimate truth that is seen by a superior being is one where there is a sheer stoppage of all elaborations of mistaken appearance, as we have read about clear word, read in Chandrakirti's clear words. by the impairment of ignorance refers to mistaken ordinary states of mind. These mistaken ordinary states of mind perceive a certain aspect in things. So the impairment comes through ignorance. Some Tibetans do not posit ultimate truth as the sheer elimination of the elaborations of the objects of negation, example the two selves. Instead they hold that as the object of a mind that non-mistakenly knows how things exist, the ultimate appears to exist under its own power, just as things such as blue and yellow appear to an ordinary mind. Ascertaining that it does not exist in that way is the view that knows the profound. They also claim that it is a misstep with regard to the correct view to regard external and internal phenomena, the basis with regard to which living beings cling to the two selves as lacking intrinsic existence. These assertions stand outside the sphere of all the scriptures, Hinayana and Mahayana. They accept that it is necessary to stop the conception of self, the root that binds all living beings and civil existence. They then assert that you do not stop the conception of self by realizing that there is no intrinsic existence in the substrata it apprehends as a self. Rather, you stop it by knowing as dual existence some other unrelated phenomena. So this is no different from the following scenario. Suppose that there is no snake in the east, but someone thinks that there is and is terrified. You say to the distraught person, you cannot stop your idea that there is a snake by thinking in the east there is no snake at all. Rather, you should think there is a tree in the west. That will stop your idea that there is a snake and will end your distress. Hence, you who wish the good for yourself should stay far away from such wrong views. You should work on the method for eradicating the way that ignorance appears things, this ignorance being the root of all that binds you and degrades you in cycle existence. Regarding this method, the texts of the Father, the Noble Nagarjuna and the spiritual Sanarya, they were clearly set forth vast collections of arguments that build deep and certain knowledge of the definitive scriptures, and how it is that the meaning of these scriptures cannot be otherwise interpreted. Relying on these texts by Nagarjuna Aryadeva, cross to the other side of the ocean of cycle existence. To avoid mistake in reaching the Madhyamika view, it is most crucial to refute wrong ideas about object of negation. For that reason, I have given an extended explanation. So we stop here. And I hope that tomorrow and the day after tomorrow I will be able to finish it. And then on 9th I am planning to give Avalokiteshvara initiation. And then those people who are in great hurry, they can start living on the evening of 9th. Then on 10th there is March arising. And then particularly for the Tibetans who came from Tibet, it's not at all convenient for you to participate. And then we have 2 days gap, 11th and 12th. Then 13, 14, 15, for these 3 days there will be Griha Samaj initiation in Upper Tantric College. So those who want to receive it, you can receive it, but you need to do the commitment of the succession and the self-generation. And if you have special interest, then you can come. Otherwise, you can depart to your respective places. So your going back is very suitable in the sense that when the weather was terribly cold, you persistently made the effort to remain here. But when the weather turns, when the weather turns fine, you leave the place. And then from 17th onwards, for around I think 3 weeks, Solinus is going to be the Samajachin, the great secret vision of the 5th Dalai Lama cycle of teachings. So within 3 weeks, he hopes that he will be able to finish the whole teaching. And that is, as you should know, this is a secret vision, and it's a tantric related teaching. And there is of course generally no special commitment. But since we are aspiring to achieve enlightenment, there will be commitment. So if possible, you should do the retreat of the eight general transmissions, or Kaji Chindal retreat. And if you are unable to do that, then the retreat in relation to the three roots, the retreat in relation to Lama, which is Thudup Yangnyin Kundu. There is a short Guru Yoga practice in relation to which you recite the mantra Guru Pema Siddhihum, and then the retreat in relation to the personal deity, which is Avalokiteshvara, where you recite mantra Mani Pema Hum, and then the root of Savalan activity is Dakinis. So I think there are few Dakinis, probably in relation to Guru Sojal or something. So these three retreats, in relation to Guru, in relation to personal deity, in relation to Daka and Dakinis, that has to be done if you are able to do that. So possible, retreat on Kaji, which is more difficult, and then if not possible, then your commitment will be retreat in relation to these three. So that will be the process. So if you think that you have interest, and if you think that you can do these commitments, then from 17th March, this teaching on secret vision will start, which has initiations, commentaries, permissions, and so forth. Admonishment to Repa Dorje Wangshuk, obeisance to all gurus. At one time when the Jyotirmala Repa was living in the Rogga Dunden cave of Dhyanmadhyan, he gave instructions to his disciples and parents and set them to meditating. As a result, they all gained good experiences. Among the disciples, there was a very industrious young man, a descendant of the tiger tribe. His deep faith in the Jyotirmala was confirmed when realization had dawned upon him. In an assembly, he said, "Dear Jyotirmala, when I think of the misery of samsara and the happiness of liberation, I cannot sit in idleness for a single moment. Please accept me as your servant and I will meditate day and night with you. Also, when I think of your merits and the noble deeds of the gurus in our lineage, all worldly merits and virtues become trifling and worthless. Pray therefore grant me the quint essential teachings of the Dharma." In reply, Milarepa saying, "My lineage is the lineage of Dorje Chang. My great grandfather was the noble Tilopa. My grandfather was the great Pandit Naropa. My father is Marva the translator. I am the yogi Milarepa. These were the fountainhead of profound instructions. Make the six mantras of my background. Now I shall tell you of the six deceptions. Monasteries are like collecting stations for hollow driftwood. There they claim that the priestly love is divine and pure. It is deceptive and illusory to me. Of such companions I have no need. I am a man who cherishes peace of mind and abhors all gossip and accusations. When the tumor heat, the inner psychic heat is kindled within, all woolen clothes are useless. Of burdensome robes I have no need. And for disheartening housework I have no desire. When detestation arises within, all things and possessions lose their worth. For business I have no appetite. For accumulating wealth I have no desire. When perseverance and industry grow within, sons and disciples cease to be important. I have no need for meetings and visitors, for they would merely interrupt devotion. When the pith instructions are practiced, Dharma preaching lose significance. Since they only incite one's pride, I have no need for books and learning. This is the song of the six deceptions in which the pith instructions may be found. Think on it and bear it well in mind." "This is indeed wonderful," said the young disciple. "Now for the sake of ignorant sentient beings like us, I pray you to sing a song relating to your own six merits and greatnesses." Milarepa then sang, "Seldom in my life have I boasted of greatness, but for praising the greatness of the lineage, I now sing the song of the six greatness. greatness is the benevolence of gurus and buddhas. Great is the grace of yidams and deities. Great is the power and might of the protectors. Great are the oral instructions of the whispered lineage. Great is Mela's perseverance and great the faith of his disciples. Now I shall sing the song of the six joys. Joy is to stay in the land of no man. Joy is to think of my guru's instruction. Joy is to sit on the hard cushion beneath me. Joy is to remain in the solitary cave. Joy it is to meet hunger and cold with indifference. Joy it is to practice the twinkle exercises and so forth. So this is the story of Rupa Dorje Wangchuk. Tsongkhapa, in his three principal aspects of the path, someone, after having seen the infallibility of what is within samsara and beyond samsara, and having destroyed all the targets of self-grasping, such a person has entered the path that pleases the Buddha. As we have been discussing, that in the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint, there is this ultimate explanation on the meaning of interdependent origination. So whether it is in terms of external objects, like mountains, forests and so forth, or it is in terms of internal human experiences or internal human qualities like consciousness and so forth, you will find that they are all in a big flux, experiencing changes depending upon their causes and factors. And this is something that is evident to all of us, and therefore if we reflect carefully, you will find that the cause and factors play a role, can make an impact in relation to the fruits. And this is because of the fact, because of the law of nature, that any existing phenomena has to come about by depending on their causes, their factors, and by dependence on many things. However, if things exist inherently or independently, as our ordinary unenlightened mind tends to perceive, then it is not possible to experience any changes. Now, for example, sometimes when you get very angry, then at that point when you are angry, you tend to see that person with whom you are angry. You feel that that person is something that is 100% horrible and negative and unchangeable. And then even if that person after a few days says something really nice, something good, but still you would not believe that such a person can say such a good advice, because you have developed this false notion that the so-called your enemy is something that is unchanging, absolute and 100% horrible and negative. And it is because of this you develop this misconception about reality and exaggerate the quality. So it is because of this perception based on wrong view, thinking that the person can never change or 100% negative. But after a few days, when that person does something extremely good or something, either you will not believe yourself, or you might think, how come that this unbelievable thing is being done by this person? So if you think on such points and experiences, then you will be able to develop some conviction and confirmation of what Master Tsongkhapa says, that this teaching of the Buddha, which teaches that everything by depending on their process factors, they lack inherent existence, they are devoid of inherent existence. And what more amazing one will find than this teaching. So it is because of this dependence on others that we talk about emptiness in the sense of having no inherent and independent existence. And if you engage in some reflection on this, then you will be able to see the truth and the element of the truth in it. So that is what Tsongkhapa is saying in this verse from the three principal aspects of the path, by saying that someone who sees the infallibility of the cause-effect relationship, and through that way, when one is able to destroy the target of focus of self-grasping, such a person has then entered path that would please the Buddha. On the very conventional level, things exist in the form of form, sound, smell, taste, and so forth, and they maintain their individual characteristics and entity without confusing and without mixing. So that kind of existence is there on a conventional level when you do not analyze and investigate. But if you analyze and investigate and try to pinpoint something from that conventional reality, you will not be able to find it. So this kind of nature is exactly the same in relation to every existent object, from the highest state of enlightenment to a very ordinary state, like a form and so forth. Just as Nagarjuna says in one of his texts, that if mirage were water, then the closer you approach, the closer you will be able to see the actual presence of water. But in the case of mirage, since it is not water, the closer you approach, the closer you will find that it is not water but just mirage. So similarly, if there is something that has inherent independent existence, then the more you analyze and search it, the more you will be able to find the truth of it. But since there is no inherent independent existence, the more you search, the more that object will disappear. So even though things appear having inherent independent existence, there is no such inherently or independently existence object. However, on the conventional level, there is cause, there is factor, there is something that brings benefit and so forth. But when you search, you do not find it. So therefore, your not being able to find it through search does not mean it is non-inherent, it is total non-existence, but it simply means that it has no absolute inherent existence. So therefore, the main reason to prove why things do not have inherent existence is that they are dependent on others, that they do not have absolute existence as they appear to our mind. So from that point of view, from the point of view of inherent existence, you do not find anything that is the focus and target of the object. So in this way, when you are able to dismantle and disintegrate all the objects of focus, then such a person has entered the path that would please the Buddha. Even though an object like a person and so forth exist on the conventional level, but they do not have any independent inherent existence. So from the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint, things appear as if they have inherent existence, not only to ordinary people like us, but even to some great philosophers. Because of this habituation with the perception of inherent existence, philosophically, they propound and say that there should be something, there should be findable when you search. And therefore, philosophical schools, the mind, like the mindfulness school of thought, they say that finally, the ultimate example of self or the person is what is known as the foundational consciousness. So they make such a presentation because of their strong habituation with the grasping of things having inherent existence. However, by following the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint, if you are able to destroy all the targets of focus of self-grasping, then such a person has entered the path that pleases the Buddha in the 60 verses by Nagarjuna. He also says the same point by saying that when the self-grasping finds a target of focus, then how such a person cannot be harmed by the afflictive emotions. However, through the reason of interdependent connection, interdependent origination, and when you develop conviction in this interdependent origination, the cause-effect relationship and so forth, then you find that there is not even the slightest trace of inherent existence. And once you are able to destroy such a focus of self-grasping, the self-grasping will not arise. And the self-grasping, which is the foundation of arisal of all afflictive emotions, when that self-grasping ceases, then afflictive emotions also cease, and thereby you will be able to cultivate all the positive spiritual path qualities, and in this way you have really entered the path that pleases the Buddha. So even if you have some kind of inkling of idea about the truth of this interdependent origination, this will definitely make some difference in transforming your mind to a positive state. And particularly in the case of arisal of these afflictive emotions, one interesting thing that you will notice is that these afflictive emotions always it always seems that these afflictive emotions need a focus of target. For example, when you get angry, then that anger really needs a target to shoot and express one's own anger. Because if in the absence of such a pinpointable target, your anger will not arise. Now, for example, when you get angry towards some person, and if you do some analysis about this interconnected reality, where is the target of your anger? To the body of the person, to the mind of the person, and so forth. This will help you do away with the target of afflictive emotions like anger, and this will then help you reduce your anger. Similarly, when you develop attachment arises because of your wrong impression that the object of your attachment is something that is 100% handsome, beautiful, attractive, interesting, and so forth. But then if you analyze carefully, why I am developing such a powerful attachment to this object? Where is the target of this attachment? Am I developing this attachment to the color, to the shape, to the sound, and so forth? Then you will really not find a pinpointable object or focus of your attachment, and this naturally will help you relax that strong development of attachment. And particularly, for example, if you think about what we experience in this world, we will find what we experience is really dependent on multiplicity of factors and causes and conditions. For example, if you take the example of the weather, as I had told you, it is dependent not only on the situation of the local weather, but it is dependent on so many happenings at a far distant place. And many of the causes, for example, your anger, maybe not necessarily due to only the immediate cause and effect, it may be due to many distant causes and factors. And for example, in the case of your enemy, how did this enemy came into being as your enemy, and why you are developing that anger? Particularly, take the example of an enemy who is supposed to be the enemy of the teaching of the Buddha. Then you can reflect from the point of view of this interconnected reality, how this enemy came into being and why you are angry towards this enemy. It is not necessary that this so-called enemy is because has become an enemy because of certain immediate factors. It may be due to many causes and factors of this year, many years back, and hundreds of even lives before, there may be some connection. And then it is not only the external object, much is dependent on your own negative emotion, which is not necessarily something that you have cultivated today, but whose roots and imprints and seeds you may have developed at a far distant period of the time. And when you reflect on all this possible multiplicity of causes and factors, then where is the target? Are you going to get angry towards all these countless factors and targets of anger? What's the reason that you focus only on this person? So in this way, when you see and develop this wider perspective, then you will be able to relax the intensity of anger and attachment and so forth. And particularly if you reflect on the meaning of the verse, Shantideva says that when you confront a difficult situation, then he says you should think whether it is changeable or not. And if it is something that you can change, do not worry, because you can change it. If it is something that you cannot change, do not worry, because by worrying you can't change it. But unfortunately, in our case, much of the problems that we face is due to our own narrow-mindedness, short-sightedness. And even if you think about this point in relation to our ordinary experiences and compare the expression and reaction of a young man comparing to an elderly person, then you will find that this elderly person, if that elderly person is not a silly one, then you will be able to find out that this elderly person who has much more experience is able to tolerate difficult situations in a much more capable way. Because in the case of young men and women, because of their lack of experience, they will not be able to tolerate even the smallest difficulties and problems. And when these young men and women make a lot of fuss about those problems, the elderly men and women will come and console them, saying, "You should not worry. This is how you should think. This is how you should handle," and so forth. So, because these elderly persons have much more experience of the reality, the possibilities of situations, and so forth, so therefore, if we develop some idea about this interconnected reality, that will help us develop more genuine understanding about the reality. And I told some of my friends, and I told some of even my Muslim friends, saying that it's good that you are a Muslim and follow Islam religion and have trust in God. But even in that case, if you develop some understanding about Buddha's teaching on interdependent relation, this will help you. So this kind of notion of interconnected reality is something that is really beneficial to everyone, whether you are Buddhist or not a Buddhist. And so instead of telling people that this interconnected reality, teaching on interconnected reality, is teaching of Buddha, but you can talk about it as a law of nature, If you just think about how an aeroplane soars into the sky, flies into the sky, you will find how even these, you know, small nails and small parts contribute towards the flight of that aeroplane.